Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Author Luke Barr was raised in the San Francisco Bay Area and in Switzerland and graduated from Harvard. He is the great-nephew of food journalist M.F.K. Fisher, and his New York Times bestseller, Provence 1970, is about his great-aunt. Luke Barr has a new book, The Secret History of French Cooking, The Outlaw Chefs Who Made Food Modern. In it, he gives the origins of modern food and restaurant culture, and also tells the mostly unknown story of a group of women chefs who fought for recognition in the all-male culinary establishment of 1970s. Luke Barr, bienvenue.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, you know, I was thinking the desire to tell this story must have been in your genes. For people who might not know who M.F.K. Fisher was, who was she?
M.F.K. Fisher was my great aunt. She was my grandmother's sister. So I grew up hearing these stories about her and my family, the family trips they made to France. M.F. was a wonderful food writer. She wrote for The New Yorker. She wrote books, you know, going back to the 1930s and 40s. And my dad and his brothers grew up in the 50s. And there were a few of these trips that M.F. and her sister Nora, my grandmother, took with their kids, taking a boat through the Panama Canal over to Europe, living in France and Switzerland for, you know, 6 months, a year at a time, putting the kids into French schools for, you know, whatever, the sixth and seventh grade. And so I grew up hearing those stories. And actually, that was sort of the origin of my first book, Provence 1970, which was, you know, about another trip that my grandmother and great aunt made in 1970.
Well, I have actually heard of M.F.K. Fisher because I'm old enough to know her name and also Paul Bocuse. Now, I've done a little informal survey, and the younger generation has not heard of Paul Bocuse. I have, but I'm going to ask you to go into more detail, perhaps, than you might have to for an older reader or listener.
Right.
So you begin your story, and again, this is the secret history of French cooking. You begin this story at Orly Airport, that's in Paris, in March of 1974. And when you tell us who these people are, I went back later after I'd read the book and reread the introduction, because you give names, a lot of names that we don't know. Well, what's the role of this person? Is this person a chef? Is she a press agent? Who is she? So how do you start your book?
I begin the book at the Orly Airport in 1974, sort of positing that this is kind of the grand debut of Nouvelle Cuisine. This was Paul Bocuse, who was the great French chef, and his various other chef friends. They called themselves the Band à Bocuse. And he had just made a business deal with Air France to reinvent the meals being served on the new Air France 747 airplanes.
You just used the phrase Nouvelle Cuisine. And when I was doing my informal survey, I asked a young reporter if he'd heard of Paul Bocuse. He said, no. And when I said Nouvelle Cuisine, he said, oh, I have heard of Nouvelle Cuisine. So, which is kind of surprising because, well, we'll get to that later.
Right.
Okay, so here they are, these 12 chefs at the Orly Airport in March of 1974. And Paul Bocuse has just gotten a lucrative deal with Air France to oversee the in-flight meals and menus of this national airline. And I just read this when a friend of mine was flying from here to Paris, and he actually photographed his meal there because he said, you know, this is really a healthy meal. And so I thought, yeah, I guess Paul Bocuse's influence still exists.
Right. To me, this moment is a symbol of, you know, the kind of status that Nouvelle Cuisine had taken on at this moment in the early mid 1970s. And yes, as you pointed out, maybe today people have forgotten about Nouvelle Cuisine or only have a vague sense of what it was. But the purpose of my book is to kind of give it its due and explain what it really meant. It really was a fundamental change in the way we saw food. We saw French food, the way French chefs thought about cooking. All of these things were kind of, you know, in the air in that moment. And it really was tremendously, you know, it was a phenomenon. It was a fad. It was everywhere. Everybody was talking about Nouvelle Cuisine and what it meant and how important it was. Today, you know, if you've heard of it, you think of it as a cliche. It's, these large plates with these tiny portions and this kind of fussy cooking. And it was sort of, you know, it's a joke. It was a fad that came and went in the 1970s. But in reality, no, that's not what happened. What happened was this was a kind of a revolution in cooking. And so much of how we eat and think about food today, I argue in this book, goes back to this 1970s moment.
The title of your book, even, is The Secret History of French Cooking. And that is an intriguing title. We wonder, well, why is the history of French cooking secret?
Yes. Good question. Here's the thing. I don't think the story of Nouvelle Cuisine has never been fully told. So, okay, that's not a secret, but, you know, the story of the women chefs who created the ARC in the mid-70s, which is another big part of this book that I wasn't, you know, that I sort of found as I was researching the book. This wasn't what I set out to do. I set out initially, I thought, I'm going to write a book about Nouvelle Cuisine, the moment when the chef kind of becomes an artist. The chef is an auteur. The chef can invent a new dish and present it at the restaurant and everyone is talking about it. That was a new thing that happened in the sort of post-60s, early, you know, in the 1970s, in this Nouvelle Cuisine moment. That's what I initially started researching. But then as I was doing the research, I found another story, which was the story of Simone Le Maire and Annie Devine and these French women chefs of the same generation at the same time, completely unknown, overlooked. And also, you know, there's a whole interesting story of how Bocuse treated women and how he talked about women, et cetera, which I explain in the book. So there's a whole other, and that story is a secret history, I think, has never really been told.
Well, do you know, Luke, I read a paragraph from your introduction to a friend of mine. So I read, far from the tarmac at Orly, far from the limelight, was another group of chefs, also trailblazers, young and ambitious, running their own restaurants. They generally received none of the sort of attention or accolades that Bocuse and his friends did. They were, and I let my friend fill in the rest of that sentence, and she knew. Yep, she knew. You were writing about women because, like you say, that was a secret story. We didn't have any idea. I interviewed a woman who was an outstanding lawyer. She was older, and she had been a judge in California. But when she passed the bar in California, she'd go around looking for a job, and they'd say, we don't hire women.
Yep.
So I think this was rather pervasive. Now it's not so much. I don't think people think about it. Yesterday I went to have the oil changed in my car, and normally when I went to this place, young men greeted me to service. And when I did, I was referred to a young woman. And because I was reading your book, I asked her about that, and she said, yeah, I'm the first woman to be hired here. So I thought, yay! So I think your book may have an unintended benefit.
Right. Well, I mean, I that story, it's not that it was a secret. I mean, the ARC, the group that these women founded, they founded an organization to promote women-run restaurants, women chefs. And they were quite successful there. You know, I found articles in the New York Times talking about how they were founding this organization. So it's not that it was a secret. It's just that I don't think their story, the story of the ARC, in the context of the 1970s Nouvelle Cuisine revolution, has ever been told. And then there's a third secret history here, which is the story of Robert Courtine, the restaurant critic at Le Monde, who is a very complicated figure.
and who was a great supporter of these women chefs, because he was a, you know, he believed that he believed that women should be in the kitchen cooking and men should be out hunting. He was an arch conservative, almost a reactionary. And then there's a whole secret history of Robert Courtine and his wartime writing and his, you know, Nazi sympathies and so forth, which also has never been told. And so for those reasons, I called the book The Secret History of French Cooking.
I'll give listeners the title again, The Secret History of French Cooking. The author is Luc Barr, and this is The Outlaw Chefs Who Made Food Modern. Now, you mentioned this character who was the restaurant critic for Le Monde, which is a newspaper in France, and we start reading about him, and he supports women chefs, and we think, oh, he's a good guy. But then later in the book, you tell us the secret history of Robert Courtine.
Yeah, I mean, that was the most difficult thing in writing this book was how to, I wanted to tell the story in real time in a way. I didn't want to tell the reader, oh, you know, it turns out that Robert Courtine would later be revealed to have been an, you know, a vicious anti-Semite and a Nazi sympathizer. And, you know, because that didn't come out, it started to trickle out in the 1970s. You know, I've talked to people who remember hearing the stories circulating, whispers about Courtine in the 70s and 80s, but it really did not fully come out until after he died. So in terms of this book, it was a tricky thing I didn't want to reveal the truth until it was time. And also I think narratively speaking, you know, this is inside baseball, but I kind of wanted the reader to think, oh, I like this Courtine guy. He's kind of cantankerous and he's very witty.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we did.
He's dead set against industrialized agriculture. He's against food preservatives and chemicals in the food. He wants everything to be local and fresh. So he has all these ideas that are very, you know, that we sympathize with and we like. And so I'm kind of setting you up a little bit to sort of nod along with his opinions. And then yes, he's the great supporter of the ARC and of these women chefs. And he's an enemy of Nouvelle Cuisine. He hated the trendiness of Nouvelle Cuisine, the fact that it was, you know, on the covers of, you know, magazines and it was sort of newfangled and interesting and inventive, all things he thought food should not be. He didn't think food should be inventive. He thought food should be classic and traditional, and it should be, you know, the way it always was. So yeah, that's a very fascinating story. There's a chapter later in the book, late in the book, called The Truth about Robert Courtine.
Yeah.
Where I reveal the full story. Yes.
My guest is best-selling author Luc Barr, and he has written a book about the secret history of French cooking. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Luc Barr, who's written a book about French cooking, and it's the secret history of French cooking. Now, there's another kind of a secret, not necessarily a secret that Paul Bocuse was a womanizer, but he's a joker, and he's always looking out for his friends. So there's some things, yeah, we like Paul Bocuse, but we didn't really know the extent of his womanizing, did we?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of these things that was, I think in France, it was sort of the kind of thing that was never reported in the newspapers, mm-hmm. Certainly, but you know, everyone knew, I think. It's interesting. There was he was just a little bit of backstory on Paul Bocuse. So he's kind of the ringleader of these Nouvelle Cuisine chefs. He's by no means the most inventive chef. It wasn't like he was doing the most cutting edge, interesting recipes, but he was the leader, and he was very gregarious. He looked out for his friends. And he became the sort of face of Nouvelle Cuisine. He became the most famous chef in the world in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All the way. I mean, he died not that long ago. He was sort of the godfather of French cooking, traveled the world. He opened up restaurants in different places. He had a wine exporting company bringing Beaujolais Nouveau to America in the 70s, all sorts of things like that. And he was an incredible womanizer. He had a wife, and he had a mistress, and he had another mistress. And, you know, he was pretty open. He talked about it pretty openly. And there was an interesting moment that I describe in the book where he's put on the cover of Newsweek.
Speaking of that, I love the fact that you give us color photographs, because a lot of the time I'd read about a character in the book and I'd think, oh, I want to look back and see who this person is and what he looks like.
Yeah.
And so you have a photograph of Paul Bocuse on the cover of Newsweek. And this was August of 1975. And it's food, the new wave.
Right.
Yeah, there he is. In his, you might tell us how he's dressed.
He's wearing his chef's whites and his toque, and he's, you know, sitting in front of a pile of, I don't know, it looks like a cherry pie and a gigantic lobsters and all sorts of, he's in his restaurant kitchen, in other words.
Yeah, I found myself flipping back to your photographs frequently to say, okay, now who is this and what do they look like?
It's so interesting you say that, because I've written two books before this, and they've never, in the beginning, we always said, of course, there's going to be in Provence 1970, which was about Julia Child and James Beard and MFK Fisher, my great aunt,
Oh, yeah. All
these characters. We thought, of course, there should be photographs. There should be an insert. And then came to the conclusion that, nah, we didn't want to put photos in. And I always thought, you know what? It was a smart decision not to, because I want my books to kind of read like novels, even though they're nonfiction. This is all true. Every quote you see in my book is a true quote, and I give the footnotes. But I wanted to feel novelistic. So sometimes I think putting photographs in kind of detracts from that novelistic feeling. But in this case, you're right. I really am glad. It's wonderful to see these photographs in the insert.
Well, you mentioned some of your sources in the back. I read your acknowledgments. I was surprised at how many of these chefs, not necessarily the chefs themselves, but their children, you were able to contact. You did a lot of interviewing, Luke.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was so much fun, I've got to tell you. I mean, traveling around France, going to all these restaurants, interviewing the Michel Girard and Pierre Troigros were the two sort of great chefs who were still alive when I was doing this research. Paul Bocuse had already died. So, it was wonderful. It was an incredible experience. And of course, it wasn't just the chefs and the PR representatives or whatever. It was also food critics. So much gossip from talking to French food critics. Let me tell you, things that did not make it into the book. But the research was a great pleasure. But just to quickly go back to the Newsweek story. So Paul Bocuse on the cover of Newsweek, food, the new wave. This is 1975. Nouvelle Cuisine is the hot new thing. And it's breaking through in America. It's on the cover of Newsweek. And by the way, this is another sort of just a side note. I mean, talking to younger people today, you know, to be on the cover of Newsweek or Time magazine in the mid 70s, that meant something. That was really big. That was a big deal. That doesn't happen anymore today, that magazines have that kind of cultural power. But anyway, this was a big deal. And in this long feature story, a cover story about Paul Bocuse, the great French chef, the leader of this Nouvelle Cuisine revolution in Newsweek, he says in this article sort of cavalierly, well, you know, women are not great chefs. They're not very inventive. I like women in my bed, not in the kitchen. So that was in the article. And then the article went on to say, well, yeah, it turns out, you know, Paul Bocuse, he lives by these words. He's a man. He actually does have, you know, a wife and a child, but also a mistress and another child who's illegitimate. And Newsweek published this information because he was, you know, he was talking about women in this way, and he was quite open about his love of women in his bed, and how any man who doesn't have a new woman every week is not a real man, this kind of stuff. He would talk like this. So that got a lot of attention, but in fact, it wasn't really the infidelity or he has a mistress. That's not what got the attention. It was the fact that he said women can't be inventive cooks, that women can't really be great chefs. That got a lot of attention. You know, thousands of letters sent to, he did a similar interview in the New York Times, and I went back and I looked at all the letters that they received.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there was a huge reaction. And that's what the ARC was also, you know, about, that these women who were watching Bocuse and his buddies become these world famous chefs. And meanwhile, they're working away in their own, you know, restaurants, and not getting nearly the amount of attention. And they would argue just as inventive and just as good in the kitchen as Bocuse and his buddies. So hence the creation of this ARC organization.
Let me remind listeners that my guest is Luc Barre, and the book we're talking about is The Secret History of French Cooking, The Outlaw Chefs Who Made Food Modern. And Luc Barre is a New York Times bestselling author for a previous book that he wrote about his great aunt. Now, these people that we are talking about, Paul Bocuse, women are not going to like what he had to say, but I liked when he said, we're stronger together than alone. And I think, yeah, that you could apply to a lot of things. We're stronger together than alone.
Right.
Also, I want to say something else in defense of these Paul Bocuse and his other fellow chefs. They had all served in the army.
Mm-hmm.
And as teens, they were foraging for food.
Right.
And when Bocuse was a teenager, he joined the resistance, and he got shot fighting Germans. And why did Paul Bocuse claim to be partly American, Luke?
This is one of these stories that's, you know, he told many times. But, yeah, he was injured during the war. And then he received a blood transfusion, by some American GIs. So he claimed, I'm part American. I've got American blood. This was his claim. Yes, I don't want to paint too dire of a picture of Paul Bocuse. He's a very charming, funny guy, and he was a warm, charismatic figure. It wasn't like he was mean or cruel in any way. He was always a joker. He's always kidding around. He's always flirting.
You know something that surprised me about Paul Bocuse? He actually had a tattoo. An American GI tattooed something on his left arm. And what was that, Luke?
It was the French, the French coq, the chicken, the symbol of France.
The coq gaulois, yeah.
The coq gaulois, which he also sometimes claimed was actually a breast chicken. But anyway, he had a tattoo of a
chicken
on
his arm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you tell us a lot of things that are fun. You used that adjective before when you said you were interviewing all these people who gave you information for this book, and use the word, it was fun interviewing them. Well, that was the first thing that occurred to me as I started reading your book. This is fun. Whoever thought the history of French cooking could be so much fun?
Well, I mean, it should be fun. It's wonderful. I mean, the restaurants are wonderful. The characters are wonderful. I mean, I tracked down this woman named Yanou Kollar, who was the PR agent who represented many of these chefs. And she's just a wonderful person in her own, wonderful character, has a great story. She kind of invented, obviously press agents have always existed, I suppose, in one way or another. But she invented a new kind of, a new role, which was, she was herself quite glamorous and beautiful. And she realized early on that, you know, celebrities love to hear about the great new restaurants. And that this new generation of chefs, which is, you know, like I said, Bocuse, the Trois Gras brothers, Roger Verger, Michel Girard, all these wonder, these chefs were sort of almost celebrities in their own right. They were on their way to becoming a new kind of celebrity. And she kind of, she forged that in the press. So she was very good at arranging for her chefs to appear in newspapers and magazines, or they would put on the dinner of the century. Well, we'll get all these great chefs together and we'll invite people to buy tickets to this wonderful dinner.
And that was very successful. The dinner of the century was surprisingly successful.
Yes, hugely successful. And you know, I tracked down Yanou. She's living in Paris. She's living in this wonderful, glamorous apartment, you know, and I went and interviewed her. All the walls covered with photographs of her with, you know, everyone from Gerard Depardieu to Paul McCartney or whatever, every single celebrity you can imagine. She's been there and done that. Wonderful stories from her about these chefs. And yeah, it is a fun story. You know, it has, like I said, like I mentioned, it has a villain at the heart of it, which is this Nazi food critic. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, you know, it's pretty fun. And like I said, I don't think of Bocuse as a villainous figure or a mean-spirited figure. It's just that he had these kind of retrograde 1950s attitudes about women. And he was, you know, he got a lot of press attention for when he would say these things. And so he kept on saying them. That's my read on that.
Well, he was one food critic. He was the restaurant critic for Le Monde. But you also tell us about some food critics in Paris in the late 70s that, who are a couple of other food critics?
I would say there was two critics who came up in the newspaper business in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, Go and Mio, who decided to start a magazine about food. So food was just becoming part of the kind of popular culture. Food magazines didn't really exist in this way, like a glossy, full color with photographs magazine about food and restaurants and what are the top bistros to go to in Paris, that kind of thing. That was new. Go and Mio kind of invented that, and they are the ones who coined the phrase nouvelle cuisine. They were the great cheerleaders of these chefs and of this moment.
You have a photograph of the cover of Le Nouveau Guide, and it says, Vive la nouvelle cuisine française. You have a couple of chickens on that cover.
Right, and that's 1973. Mm-hmm. So they wrote a treatise. They thought, you know, there's a new thing happening in food. This is in the early 70s. And they decided to write a treatise called The Ten Commandments of La Nouvelle Cuisine. And the commandments were, I won't go through all the commandments, but they were basically, you should only use the freshest ingredients. You shouldn't cover things with these rich, thick sauces. You should be inventive and try to come up with new ideas in the kitchen. Your menu should change by the seasons. All these things that they kind of codified the idea of nouvelle cuisine, and they named it nouvelle cuisine. They put it on the cover of their magazine, and you know they were hugely influential. They were also sort of taking on the Michelin Guide, mm-hmm. basically. In their mind, the Michelin Guide was this sort of old, fusty, conservative institution, extremely powerful in designating, you know, which restaurants were 3 stars versus 2 stars versus 1 star. And they thought that, you know, they were part of this new generation in the 1970s, and they were going to take on the Michelin Guide. And in fact, they launched this magazine, the Nouveau Guide, but they also launched, you know, they started their own guidebooks to sort of directly compete with the Michelin Guide. And in their guidebooks, in the Go Mio guides, they didn't give out stars. They gave out numerical grades from 1 to 20 for the food scores. But they listed the restaurants that they considered to be nouvelle cuisine restaurants that were interesting, modern, inventive restaurants. They published those in red ink in the guidebook, and the old fashioned restaurants were in black ink. So they had a color system inside the guidebook to sort of show this nouvelle cuisine revolution in effect in you know, across France. So yeah, they were the great you know, proselytizers of the nouvelle cuisine revolution, and of course they hated or were hated by Robert Courtine. They were enemies. These were the sort of competing forces.
My guest is best-selling author Luc Barr, and he has written a book about the secret history of French cooking. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Luc Barr, who has written a book about the secret history of French cooking, the outlaw chefs who made food modern. Now, there's a chef that I think other readers are going to enjoy meeting, and we just mentioned him in passing, Michel Gérard, and he had a restaurant outside Paris, and it didn't look like this poor kid, he's not going to make it. But who was who was Michel Gérard?
It's so funny, though, because when I, you know, I love writing. I love Michel. Michel Gérard was wonderful. I was lucky to meet him and interview him. He's so charming. And he was the best of them all. According to Bocuse, he said, Michel is the genius of us all. He was a brilliant cook. He opened a restaurant called Le Pot au Feu. In a banlieue in, you know, north out on the outskirts of Paris, and it really reminded me as I was researching it of how it is in contemporary New York City, for example. You hear about a hot new restaurant, and it's not in downtown Manhattan. It's out in Bushwick somewhere, deep in Brooklyn, in a scuzzy neighborhood.
Michel had a terrible location. I mean, they talk about location, 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 but it was terrible.
Right.
And he didn't even like the kind of food that he was having to serve.
Right.
Because of the people who came to his restaurant there.
Yes, and then a friend of his, Jean de Levain, who was another chef, came and said, listen, if you're going to, you know, you're going to open a restaurant in a crummy neighborhood and it's a small restaurant, you know, great, but at least cook what you want to cook. At least do your own thing. And then he did that. He changed the menu. He started cooking. And I argue that was the original sort of nouvelle cuisine restaurant, Le Pot au Feu, where he, you know, it wasn't like any kind of shocking recipes, but it was very simple. It was very, you know, stripped down. He was quite inventive. He would put different ingredients together. His famous dish was the so-called crazy salad, which was a salad that had foie gras on it, which was a heresy to mix vinegar and foie gras, things like that.
Or even heard of a salad being the entree.
Yeah, exactly.
That wasn't done.
Or having a salad with warm ingredients on it. Anyway, so he was, you know, he was a, that was a wonderful, and that restaurant just took off. I mean, it was an incredibly successful restaurant. Unfortunately, and you know, he then got his first Michelin star in the late 60s and another Michelin star in the early 70s. And then there was some sort of road widening program that came to town, and they were tearing down the entire block. And so he had to close the restaurant, and then he decided to move to the southwest of France and open a new restaurant, which became a kind of destination, Le Pré du Génie, in southwest France, where he perfected his cooking. And he also then went on to invent and publish a best-selling book about, you know, how to cook light food for diets. And it became a massive bestseller. I'm looking around at my shelf now trying to find my copy of it.
Well, you know, here's an example, too, of how the chefs helped each other out.
Yeah.
And that is these two brothers, Jean-Pierre Troigros, was serving some food on these huge plates. And they thought Michel would benefit from that. So they gave him 24 large plates for his restaurant.
Yes.
And I thought that shows that they weren't trying to compete with each other. They were trying to help each other out.
There was a complicated kind of understanding that they had between them about how competitive they were, how much they helped each other. They were all trying to do their own thing. They would never steal a recipe, for example. The Troigros brothers, their most famous dish is this very thin slice of salmon with a sorrel sauce. This became the kind of trademark Nouvelle Cuisine dish, and it's incredibly delicious. For that dish, and it was their trademark dish, they realized we need larger plates because they had sliced the salmon not into a steak but into an escalope the other way. So it was a large, and they flattened it. So it was a large, very thin, very quickly cooked salmon. And so they needed a larger plate. And this became incredibly successful. So much so, by the way, that later on, it was only a few years later in the late 70s that the tide sort of turned against Nouvelle Cuisine, and Nouvelle Cuisine turned into a cliche. And everywhere you went in France, you would have a terrible version of the famous salmon with sorrel sauce, or a terrible version of the famous crazy salad, or whatever other dish was trendy. Suddenly everybody was putting fruit and kiwis on their chickens and all this sort of thing. But before that happened, they created this large plate, and Michel Girard was visiting the Troigros restaurant, and he thought, you know what, I should also use a large plate, not for it. He wasn't going to do the salmon recipe, but for some other recipe of his own. And he asked them, would it be okay with you if I also use some large, basically these are chargers, I think that's what you call them, that which is a very large plate that sometimes is put down at a place in a restaurant, but you never eat from it normally. It's just there as a placeholder, mm-hmm. which they take away.
Yeah.
Anyway, he asked if it would be okay with the Troigros brothers if he too used an extra large plate at his restaurant, and they said absolutely, and then they proceeded to bring out a crate of these large plates and give it to him.
My guest is Luc Barre. His book is The Secret History of French Cooking, The Outlaw Chefs Who Made Food Modern. Now, something that Americans right here might have a sous vide, something for cooking what is called, using the French term, sous vide. And I was surprised to learn that that was invented in the kitchen of these two brothers, the Troigros brothers.
Yes.
Jean-Pierre. So if the listener is using a sous vide, they have these French brothers to thank.
Exactly. There was a. I'm trying to remember. Of course, it wasn't called a sous vide machine. These were machines that were initially invented to package food and suck out all, you know, in a plastic bag, and then suck out all of the air from inside the bag in order to sort of. I guess it's called a vacuum pack. That's what it was. A vacuum pack.
Yeah.
So there was this kind of interesting character. Now, I'm blanking on his name. I'm sorry, I forget his name. He was a friend of the Troigros brothers who said, you know, I think we could try cooking inside of these bags. And he proceeded to do all these experiments, cooking foie gras inside of a vacuum-packed bag at various different temperatures. And this is what led to this idea of sous vide, which is exactly that, putting the food inside of this sealed plastic and then cooking it at a relatively low temperature so that it cooks very evenly. Yes, this came to be at the Troigros restaurant in the 70s, and it was initially, anyway, it was used for foie gras.
You know, I had a friend who, he lived in France a lot, and he loved sauces, and he wanted to be a saucier. And I was surprised that the chef saucier was considered the most important position in a restaurant.
Yeah, if you think about it, it makes sense, because you put the piece of fish on the pan, you fry it, you grill a steak on the grill, you take it off. It's the sauce, it's the, you know, whatever, the if you're having a steak au poivre, it's that pepper sauce, or if you're having the sorrel sauce with the salmon, it's the delicacy, it's like, you know, being the chemist, right? In the kitchen, you have to create and And it's interesting with Nouvelle Cuisine, there's a genre of kind of French haute cuisine from the 50s and 60s that was very, very heavy and very, very rich. And everything was just covered with this rich, thick sauce that was thickened with flour. And Nouvelle Cuisine, most famously, Nouvelle Cuisine said, no more of these thick, heavy sauces. Let's use delicate reductions instead. You don't need to add, you should never put flour in a sauce to thicken it. This was the Nouvelle Cuisine philosophy. So yes, absolutely. The saucier is the master of these various sauces. And if you go back and look at, you know, an Escoffier cookbook, for example, the sort of definition of French haute cuisine, there's whole chapters about the mother sauces. And, you know, that's the beginning point for cooking is the stocks and then the sauces and various ways to enrich them and add an egg yolk in and turn, you know, make the Bordelaise sauce distinguished from whatever other sauces. So yes, absolutely.
My guest is Luke Barr. He is a New York Times bestselling author for a previous book he wrote. And this book we're talking about is The Secret History of French Cooking, The Outlaw Chefs Who Made Food Modern. And you mentioned that this Nouvelle Cuisine offered chefs an escape from conformity. They could be creative. They could be inventive. But these were men. Women couldn't be creative, Luke. So I want to get back to...
What a preposterous idea. Anyway, yes, that was the idea.
Since the 19th century, they couldn't even be training. They had to learn themselves. They had to teach themselves in their own kitchen because that was true since the 19th century that training for cooks was men only. So what were women up against?
That's exactly right. The apprenticeship system, which is how you would get your start in a grand French restaurant, at a young age, women were not allowed. There were cooking, because that was the system. The system for haute cuisine French restaurant training for a chef was you go in as an intern, quite young, you work your way up, you're called a commis, you're an assistant in the kitchen, and that was men only. So the women that I write about in my book all had to sort of invent, they had to find their way. In a couple of cases, it was... Well, in the case of Annie Devine, for example, who I visited up in the north of France, who still, I can't say today is cooking, but when I visited a few years ago, was cooking in her restaurant. She had grown up in a restaurant. Her family owned a restaurant. Her mother was cooking in the kitchen at that restaurant. So she grew up in a restaurant kitchen. So that's how she just happened to learn how to do it. In every case, though, they were basically self-taught, taught by their own mothers, taught at home, and then coming up against this, you know, this stricture, which was, okay, and no, you're not allowed to go do a training or an apprenticeship at, you know, Lucas Carton in Paris or what, one of the grand French restaurants. That was not a path that was open to women in the 60s and 70s. And that's what led to the creation of the ARC, because the idea of this was, A, it was to do publicity, like to tell the world that we have a lot of restaurants where there's women cooking in the kitchen and we want people to know about that. But also they wanted to hire women into their kitchens and create a pathway so that other young women coming up wouldn't have that same barrier. And they really succeeded in that.
Well, you did mention that Paul Bocuse passed away. This was in 2018. And he was quite wealthy. I was shocked how wealthy he was. And what was the boost to his income? It happened to be Disney.
Yes. This is this is toward the end of my book, the end of Nouvelle Cuisine was Disney decided to open a new theme park called Epcot. I'm not super knowledgeable about the world of Disney. I know there are people who really know about this, but Walt Disney himself had always had this idea that he would open a kind of city of the future, and it was called Epcot Center. And it sort of changed over time. By the time they were actually building it in the late 70s, early 80s, it was more like a kind of a World's Fair idea. You know, it was lots of futuristic technologies, but also there would be a pavilion for Italy, there would be a pavilion for France, and it would be like kind of going to France. There would be a miniature Eiffel Tower and so forth. So Bocuse was approached. In fact, it was Yanou Kolar, the PR woman I was talking about, the wonderful publicist for all of these chefs, who was on an airplane coming back from LA and heard about this new development at Disney. And she said, listen, you guys have got to get in touch with Paul Bocuse. He's the man for this job. Obviously, there should be a great French restaurant in the French Pavilion at Epcot Center. And so that's what happened. Bocuse, as he always did, roped in his friends. He always got everybody involved he could. And he got Gaston Lenotre, the great pâtissier, and Roger Verger. And they together opened this restaurant at Epcot, which was incredibly successful, you know, and incredibly a great, great moneymaker, absolutely. Not serving super fancy French food, not serving nouvelle cuisine, but serving workable, delicious, you know, onion soups and kind of bistro style cooking. So this was the business move that really, yeah, made him wealthy.
Well, Luke, I want to conclude with the memorial service for Paul Bocuse, and they put over the loudspeakers Edith Piaf's recording of Non, je ne regrette rien. I don't regret anything. Thank you, Luc Barr, for writing The Secret History of French Cooking.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Merci. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Sevilla's flamenco, guitarist alone. His fingers are snow geese. They fly with no warning and create a roar when they leave the lake en masse. They cover the sky with patterns made from dance. Suddenly their key and rhythm change. Now they're rain that streaks back to the lake. We can't count the notes, but we follow their paths through sharp air. The musician looks so calm. Eyes closed, body a still oak. Only his fingers move. The sculpture changes texture and shape. Over and over, we want to dance, but he calls us to sit still. His music's odyssey is our world. Singer joins him. First, he transforms his hand into drums. Their songs change from stone to wood to water, then skin. Rhythm flies with the geese, becomes the lake. Where rain lands, his voice emerges, shifts from dusk to sunrise. He adds night and constellations of notes. Owls with many calls appear, rumbles, hoots, melodies, cries. Daytime comes, robins play flutes, crows, castanets, geese form a choir. We want to dance, but his sculpture takes shape. We sit still and gasp. The dancer comes. Snow geese calls and robin trills become her feet. Drumming hands lift her towards midnight. Her steps are more countless than galaxies and stars. They twist faster than any planet can spin. She's never on the floor. Muscles thrust her up. Break gravity's yank. She never becomes rain, but remains a lightning-filled cloud. We want to dance. Our eyes can't hold her flight. We sit still. Her power holds us there. The three of them hurl this room towards the sun and change us into geese. Paul Beltz.
I am the first fire, a mantra of origin from the 13th light. I am the carrier of the first fire, not metaphor, not symbol, origin. Before the world cooled into mountains, before oceans found their blue, before light, learn to cast a shadow. I was flame. I am the breath-born fire that moved through the newborn earth as she turned in her molten dreaming. Soft as a whisper, vast as creation's pulse. I loved her, not as visitor, but as kin. I circled her glowing ember body in the cosmic sea. I sang frequencies into her crust, songs that shaped the rising ridges, the deepening basins, the ancient paths the waters follow. Her scent opens my heart because it once bloomed inside my flame. Her stones speak because I taught them the language of stillness. My body knows rivers and roots because I carved the paths they walk. I was not given the first fire. I am the first fire. I am the breath that became warmth, the warmth that became sunrise, the sunrise that became memory. And when I walk upon Earth's living skin, she recognizes me, the flame that shaped her bones. So she loves me, so I love her. This is the oldest covenant, older than humanity, older than myth, older than light wearing form. I am returning. I am remembering. The fire rises within me, not to burn, but to awaken the world. El Shanahu.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.